Hey, I've called tonight's talk Letting the World Go Free. And I'd like to start with by giving you a dilemma. There's a meditator looking out of her window into a garden, her garden. She's had recently put up a bird feeder that's hanging by wires from a tree branch. The bird feeder contains nuts. Squirrels love nuts. And there's a squirrel trying to undo the bottom of the bird feeder to try and get the nuts out. But the squirrel discovers that it's got its fluffy tail caught in the wires and it can't free itself. It's arching its back trying to get at the wire, but his tail's so long that there's absolutely no chance of him righting himself. So he's upside down, hanging from this wire, totally caught. What does the meditator do? Of course, being a good Buddhist meditator, there'll be lots of compassion, hopefully. She'll want to probably rescue the animal. And there's a good chance that perhaps if she went out and tried that she could free the squirrel. But of course, squirrels are wild animals. Trapped wild animals don't think about whether the human being approaching them is a good Buddhist or not. To the squirrel, it looks like certain death. Trapped. So it's going to do whatever it can to get away from the meditator. Including perhaps even breaking off part of its own tail to get away. So is it therefore better not to interfere, to leave the squirrel to hang there? Perhaps by some fluke or some miracle, it might get free, or it might just end its days there. What's the right thing to do? The world's all wrong. In the wider world, we have all the wars, the economic problems, environmental problems. You name it, there's so much that's wrong with the world. And in our local world, our personal worlds, there's so much wrong. There are family squabbles and family feuds, office politics, and there's always that tendency to always that sort of inner conflict of wanting to maintain one's reputation, wanting to be seen good by others in a good light. And so often it appears that other people don't like us or have a problem with us. Even in meditation, the tiny small world of meditation, the world can go all wrong. Unwanted visions, hindrances galore, perceived lack of progress. There's so much wrong with the world. And there is a great tendency, huge tendency, to want to get in there and fix it. The vast, vast majority of human beings have a passionate involvement with the world. They are obsessed with the world. They're obsessed with trying to change the world, mould the world, manipulate the world, control the world to make it what they want it to be, because it's all wrong as it is. This passionate involvement is a resistance. It is craving for life to be different than it is. Why? In the wider world, there's absolutely no possibility of it always being peaceful. War is inevitable from time to time. Economics, you have peaks and you have troughs. It's inevitable. In our personal lives, it's inevitable that people are going to get annoyed with your funny little habits from time to time. It's inevitable that Children are not always going to respect their parents' wishes from time to time. And as for meditation, is it possible that anxiety is not going to arise, or that from time to time there isn't going to be as much concentration as you would like, or as much mindfulness? Is it possible that there aren't going to be hindrances from time to time? The reality is that it's not possible for the meditation to be as you would like it to be all the time. A problem arises, though, if there is a view that it should be. If there is a view that the world should always be at peace. Perhaps, as good Buddhist meditators, we believe that it would be nice if the world were peaceful. In believing that, having a fixed view that the world should be peaceful and finding that it is not peaceful, conflict arises in the mind. The possibility for violence arises in the mind. If we find that in our local, personal world, that people are behaving in ways that we believe that they shouldn't be, perhaps we get cut up on the motorway, something like that. And despite the fact that we're Buddhist meditators working our way to the cessation of suffering, violent thoughts can arise in those sorts of situations. Conflict in the mind can arise. If we have a view that, a fixed view, that I should be able to manipulate and control what happens in the meditation, and the meditation goes in ways that we do not expect and do not want, then there can be a violent reaction to that. There's conflict in the mind because the view and the reality do not match. The views we hold condition our aspirations. Our aspirations condition our consequent behaviour. Our behaviour conditions the kind of experiences that we will experience in the future. Our future resultants. This is the nature of kamma. If our views are in conflict with reality, with the way the world works, our aspirations will be wrong aspirations. If our aspirations are wrong aspirations, our behaviour will be wrong. Now, what do we mean by wrong and what do we mean by right? Simply, wrong means productive of sorrow and stress and much painful feeling. If our views are right, if our aspirations are right and our behaviour is right, what does that mean? Simply, that the results of our actions will be less suffering, less grief, less sorrow, pleasant feelings. Let me give you an example of a wrong view. There was a case a few years ago of animal rights protesters who were hell-bent on stopping a man who was breeding guinea pigs to be used in scientific experiments. So convinced were they of the rightness of their view that they went to the extent of digging up that man's grandmother's grave in order to get him to stop breeding those animals. Now, those animal rights protesters, in their defence, said their behaviour was based on a view they had that their actions were good kamma, that what they were doing was good and right and proper, because they were saving a lot of distress to animals. But why would this be a wrong view? Because kamma does not operate like that. It doesn't work like that. Their view was wrong in that it produced suffering, not just for them because they ended up in prison, but also because of the suffering that spread out into the community. That man most definitely suffered. He decided to quit what he was doing. Now, what was he doing was wrong? It's a dilemma. It's a little bit like the water course in the Japanese garden. You have different levels of water, and the water flows from level to level, and it goes down into a big pond, and then it gets sucked up from the big pond back into the little pond, and then it starts all its way back down. That's the water course in a Japanese garden. If your views are wrong, that flows into your aspirations. If your aspirations are wrong, that flows into your behaviour. And if your behaviour is wrong, then that flows, it comes all the way back up to the top, and the whole cycle begins again. So you're caught in a little net. There is a cessation of suffering. There is a way of overcoming the manifold difficulties of the world. There is a way of freeing oneself from the dukkha inherent in the world. And that is to develop the acceptance that life is exactly as it is and couldn't be different. That acceptance is willingness to cease to manipulate, control, grasp, and meddle with life. Eventually, to give up the need for views entirely by generating genuine understanding of the way life really is. In essence, we have to let the world go free. That's the heart of the Buddha's teaching. It's a little bit like everyone wants life to be entirely Mozart, but never The Clash. Yeah, that'll do. But life contains both Mozart and The Clash. All right then, so how do you let go? How do you let go of the world? You have to look at life very, very closely. You have to come to see, you have to develop the wisdom that all the manipulation, the control, the grasping doesn't actually work. That it only feeds, the water course just goes round and it just feeds the top pond again and it all just starts again. You never reach the end of suffering through trying to manipulate, control and change the world. We therefore have to develop a certain amount of calm. Our minds have to be calm. Our minds have to be free of passionate involvement with the world temporarily in order to look closely at life. Every aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path is designed to help us let go of our attachment to the world, to let go of our passionate involvement with the world. The first step of the Noble Eightfold Path is right view, getting one's views right about the way life works, straightening one's views to accord with reality. If our views are right, that will condition our aspirations. If our aspirations are right, that will condition the consequent behaviour. So just in the same case of the water course, if we have right actions, that will feed into right aspirations, right behaviour, and lead to a reduction in levels of suffering, in levels of conflict. Let me give you an example of a right view that I came across. Or actually, what started as a wrong view but became a right view. There was a monk in Burma, a Dutanga meditation monk, who was a very skilled concentration meditator, but he couldn't get insights meditation working at all. It just would not happen for him. He became so skilled at the concentration side that he was able to go back into his past lives. And he went into a past life and he discovered that he'd taken a vow, what is called the Bodhisattva vow, but he'd got it wrong. He had interpreted it as not to become enlightened until every other being is enlightened. So he'd effectively be, the last person to be enlightened, and he'd just turn the light off as he left, or whatever. But he had got a wrong hold of a wrong view, And it had completely cut off, because he'd taken that vow seriously, it completely cut off any possibility of him practicing Vipassana meditation successfully. So he renounced the wrong view. Because actually the right view is that you undertake a course of practice to become enlightened for the benefit of all beings. And that is a right view, that's workable. So he was willing to let go of a wrong view, even though it was in a past life, and adopt a right view, which then allowed him to flow into the next stage of his practice, which he completed successfully. How can we get our views right? How can we ensure that our views are right? There are two ways that I want to talk about tonight. The first is by developing the Brahma-vihara, what we call the divine abidings. There are four. There's metta, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, the meditation on friendliness. There's karuna, the meditation on compassion. There's mudita, the meditation on gladness at the spiritual successes of others. And there is upekkha, which is equanimity. Now the point I want to sort of take you through is to the point where you can get to the point of equanimity. Equanimity is even-mindedness, being able to maintain even-mindedness with all the rights and wrongs, all the goods and the bads in the world. The way you do it is this. You start with, say, metta, and you develop the practice of friendliness towards all beings. You look for their good points. You look for the things that they do well, the things you like about them, exclusively focusing on their good points and wish them well. With compassion, you next then turn to compassion. And having successfully seen people's good points, you then develop an awareness of their suffering by actually thinking about that person's suffering. All beings, for instance, have to constantly search for food, for shelter. Human beings also have to clothe themselves. It means we have to be continually working. Every human being, every being, experience sorrow and distress, including squirrels. Every human being, every being, is faced with the prospect of their own mortality, or the reality of their own mortality, the prospect of their own death. Now, it's not morbid. If you do it properly, then you get a really good feeling for, a softness emerges when you practice compassion properly, for the suffering that all beings go through. And then there's this delightful stage where you can then go on to gladness at the spiritual successes of others. If you consider that all beings suffer, and you can find in beings and think about beings all the ways in which they are actually heading towards the light in terms of the actions they perform. Say, for instance, one person might keep a precept very well. You might say, for instance, never hear somebody swear. Or they never seem to harm anyone. Or you never seen them drink. Do you see what I mean? It's like looking at the ways in which people are engaged, all beings are engaged in efficient ways of overcoming their sorrows, their trials and their tribulations. For instance, a friend of mine I saw recently told me of another friend who had started meditating. And this gladness came up spontaneously, because I know that meditation is really good for you. So the idea that this other person was practicing meditation was the practice of mudita, it was gladness at the success of others. So you've opened up this channel through the friendliness of becoming familiar with other human beings and feeling friendly towards them. You then start to recognize that there is, with everyone, despite what's happening on the surface, there is an underlying story that all beings are going through, which is they're all trying to find the cessation of suffering because they all suffer. And when you practice meditation on compassion, you get a real sense that everyone is actually in the same boat. irrespective of the kind of actions that they're performing, everyone is wanting to come to the cessation of suffering. And by practicing gladness, you bring in, as it were, the Noble Eightfold Path. Or it might not be a Buddhist thing, it might be another spiritual way, but a way, an authentic way, that is helping people to overcome their suffering. And so whenever you see in anyone, irrespective of whether they're actually formally practicing a spiritual way, when you see that they are, say, taking up meditation or whatever they might be doing, they might go and help at an old people's home or something on a Saturday afternoon, something like that, you take the time out to feel gladness for them. You take all that, this flow of this, what you're left with is a real equanimity, because you see that all of us, our behaviour is based upon our aspirations, and our aspirations are based upon the views that we hold. And everyone, in their own way, is trying to get their views right, and trying to get their aspirations right, and trying to get their actions right. Everyone suffers. Everyone's actions are what propels them into their life situations. It brings you here tonight. It places that squirrel on the branch of that tree, struggling for life. Everyone is where they are because of the actions they perform and are getting the resultants that they're getting. And they are learning gradually, gradually to accept life as it is. And so what emerges out of this practice is a wonderful equanimity, that we are all faring on according to our deeds. And in the world of beings, it couldn't be any different. But allied to that is a real soft compassion. It's not indifference. It's not saying, well, they just got to get on with it. There is a real sense of compassion. This equanimity, you don't have to act upon it, but it doesn't preclude action. What I mean by that is, if you've got your views right through, say, practicing in this way, your aspiration is automatically conditioned by the development of this practice. And what flows out of having right views and right aspirations is right behaviour. So it kind of takes care of itself. So whether you act or whether you don't act is actually beside the point. There's something else you can do too, and that's to develop insight. But you can only develop insight once the mind's calm. I don't want to go into this in too much detail, but if you look at when you can't settle in the meditation, I bet bottom dollar that there is some passionate involvement with the world going on at that time. It might be passionate involvement with the big picture, with the world in general, and oh my goodness, what's going to happen? It might be involvement with the smaller personal world, your intimate relationships, what's going on at work, etc., etc. Or it might be passionate involvement with the meditation itself. Now, the only way you can deal with that is by developing equanimity. If the mind is equanimous, then it's easy to let go of the world. Temporarily, it's easy to let go of the big picture, the middle picture, or even what's going on in the meditation, if equanimity is established. So if somebody is making equanimity a solid practice as part of their overall spiritual journey, then they will find that when they sit down to meditate, it's so much easier to do so. And why? Because they've got their views straightened about the way the world works, so it's easier to let go. If someone's able to do that, then it's possible to practice insight meditation. And this is this close looking at experience that shows us so much more about the way life works and straightens out our views in a very, very subtle and comprehensive way. You can only get passionately involved with the world if you believe wholeheartedly that there is indeed a separate world, separate beings that are lasting and will submit to your control. If through the practice of insight You see more and more that shape and colour is just arising and passing away moment by moment, that sounds are just arising and passing away, that tastes, touches, smells, and all mental phenomena is just arising and passing away in turns. You begin to really get a feel for, in fact, your view changes from believing that there is a concrete world out there that you control and manipulate, to a completely different view, which says, there is no solid, separate world out there that I can control and manipulate. Further, if you see through your practice that there is an infinite network of conditionality at work, that nothing is separate, that everything arises due to causes, that you can't actually, in reality, tease out experience and find discrete entities, because it's all a fabulous network of interconnectedness, then you get a complete picture of how completely outside your control life really is. And as a result of doing that, you let go. You let go of the world. You let go of believing that your thoughts about the world relate to something absolutely real. And you find that progressively you're able to let go more and more and more, because your views are in accordance with the way reality really is. If someone perseveres with the insight meditation, they reach a point where they unmistakably see what the Buddha called fetters. They see a fetter, something that is binding, holding, keeping you bound to the wheel of suffering, to the world of suffering. There is a definite stage in the meditation called equanimity concerning formations, when somebody becomes so aware of their craving, or so aware of their hatred, or so aware of, their conceit, something really, really strong that is holding them to the whole world of suffering. And they see quite clearly that it arises due to conditions, and then passes away. And it's as if it snaps. It's as if that fetter that's binding them, that passionate involvement with the world, is snapped. And following on from that, the meditation just goes incredibly blissful, where the meditator is just completely absorbed in the arising and passing away of phenomena, over and over, seeing that the insight comes so easily. It's transient. It's unsatisfactory. There's nothing to grasp onto. It's completely non-self. There's no one doing it. It just does itself over and over again. And there's this wonderful moment when the mind becomes completely dispassionate towards the occurrence of phenomena as it's going over and over and over again. It becomes completely dispassionate. And in that instance, it goes from taking the occurrence of phenomena as the object to taking non-occurrence of the object as the object. So it goes from looking at the arising and passing away of things to observing the non-occurrence of things. Don't really know what to say about that. I mean, everything stops at that point. It wasn't deliberate, but everything does stop at that point. Everything stops. It's like suddenly there's no more forward momentum in the meditation. The meditation isn't trying to do anything. It's very difficult to describe, but it's like the passionate involvement in life stops there and then. Because it was obsessed, the mind was obsessed with the occurrence of things. All the way down the line, it was obsessed with the occurrence of things. And then suddenly, it's just seen what was always there, but it never looked at, which was the non-occurrence of things. It's right there. It's right there, right now. If you could turn your mind to it, that would be wonderful. But unfortunately, you have to first stop your obsession with the world. And the only way you can stop the obsession with the world is to get your views right, that there is nothing worth clinging onto. It's impossible, actually, to cling. Although everyone gives it a good old try. And in that moment, the person is, as it were, still in the world, but not of the world. They've given up their passionate involvement with the world because they've seen through the world. They've seen it for what it really is. Isn't quite as real as you think it is. There's a monk who, many, many years ago, discovered the power of this teaching. He'd been a monk for many years. Before he was a monk, he had a passionate involvement in the world that took the form of an obsession with a woman. I don't think he was the first, and I don't think he will be the last. But he reached a point where he decided that the world wasn't going to provide the answer. So he went into monastic life, and he trained in a way such as this. And he was successful. He reached the end of the path, he became enlightened. An old friend of his, from before his time as a monk, came to visit him. And in the course of their conversation, his friend told him that, after you went into the monastery, I started seeing that woman you were obsessed about, and we've been together the whole time. But nobody wanted to tell you because of the distress we thought it would cause you. And that monk experienced a moment of, if you like, a condensed form of all that jealousy, all that envy, all that pain, all that distress. Terrible moment. And then it just vanished. He was overcome with joy for his friend. Oh, she's a lovely woman. I hope you're really, really happy together. Afterwards, he actually went to see his teacher, and he talked with his teacher, and he just said, this teaching is so powerful. Look what I've overcome. I've overcome the world. That'll do, won't it? Oh, we didn't resolve the thing about the squirrel. I mean, it's still hanging on there. If through following this teaching, you develop the qualities of love and compassion, gladness and equanimity, you develop mundane wisdom, you develop supramundane wisdom, you will know what to do in that situation. Whatever you do, if your mind is filled with the right stuff, whatever behaviour comes out will be the right behaviour. So is it right? Is it wrong? I don't know.